Welcome to Clinical Conversations. It's a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending May 21st. This is podcast number 88. I'm Joe Elia. Choosing between open repair versus the endovascular approach to abdominal aortic aneurysm is our topic this week. We've got the New England Journal of Medicine's editorialist as our guest. For links to earlier offerings, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. And for a detailed look at what's new in clinical medicine, go to jwatch.org. We start, as usual, with a summary of the week's top clinical news. Well, I did say clinical, didn't I? But really the big deal in biosciences this week was the announcement that Craig Venter's lab had managed to stuff the reassembled genome of one bacterial species into the cytoplasm of another, and the resultant organisms were clearly genetic offspring of the new DNA. A big deal indeed, but not for clinical use yet. Of more clinical importance today is the fact that dengue, formerly found in the U.S. only among travelers to the tropics, is now originating in the subtropical U.S. itself, namely Key West. The CDC says to keep dengue in mind when febrile patients have eye pain, leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, and rash. Finally, just a reminder of something you already knew. Primary care patients on antibiotics for respiratory or urinary tract infection are at greatly increased risk for their infecting organisms to develop resistance. The authors of the BMJ meta-analysis say that the wise clinician will use the fewest number of antibiotics and prescribe them for the shortest period possible. But you knew that. That's it for the news. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. This week's New England Journal of Medicine presents several studies on repairing abdominal aortic aneurysms, specifically measuring the pros and cons of endovascular versus open repair. In short, endovascular repair presents fewer short-term risks than the open approach, but their survival rates in the long term are almost identical. The endovascular approach does come with a need for more reinterventions, however. An editorial puts all of this into perspective nicely, and we're fortunate to have the editorial writer, Dr. K. Craig Kent, as our guest today. Dr. Kent is professor of surgery and chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome, Dr. Kent.
Thank you.
The endovascular approach, according to your editorial, now verges on comprising about two-thirds of these repair procedures, yet the evidence for late complications is mounting. Do you think that in the long term the survival rates will begin to favor the open approach?
I don't think so. And in essence, that's what the findings of these two studies show. When these studies were first organized, about 2 years after their initial reports were made, and in those initial reports, we saw that within the first 30 days, there was a really great favorable outcome for the endovascular patients. Mm-hmm. But then at 2 years, the curves essentially came together. So there were some late deaths in the endovascular group. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, in the first iteration of these studies, we were worried that further late deaths might lead to the curves actually crossing, and that over the long term, the outcome might be that the mortality is higher in the endovascular group because of these late deaths. So that's what we were very fearful about. So there was a fair amount of expectation around the recent report of these studies, and in fact, they do show that the curves come together, that the late mortality is equivalent for open and endovascular repair, but that the curves actually stay together. They come together 2 years and then up to 6 and 8 years, respectively, for the two studies. They stay together. So it doesn't seem that for the endovascular group there is a continued mortality that ultimately makes this a procedure that's less favorable than open repair. So that's really the important outcome of this study, is that the curves stay together, the mortality over the long term is equivalent. It's not worse for endovascular repair. And my way of looking at this, and I think this is true for many patients and many practitioners, is that if there's an early advantage to endovascular repair, if the mortality is early on, say within 30 days or a quarter of that of open repair, and one's ability to get through the operation is significantly more favorable than for open repair. And then the long-term outcomes are equivalent. Most patients and most practitioners are going to choose the endovascular approach. So So I guess to sum, the long-term outcomes are equivalent, not worse for endovascular, and that was really the major theme of these studies.
Now, the long-term outcomes that we're talking about are the long-term so far. We've gone out, the researchers have gone out to, what, 8 years?
8 years, yes.
At the most. Is it, and I noted that one of the complications that they mention is migration of that device. Are they going to continue following these patients, or is it time to set up a whole new cohort to study?
I'm certain that they'll continue to follow these patients, and I'm certain that there'll be another iteration of the both trials at some point down the line. But there are several points that I think are important. First of all, the curves have remained parallel. Really identical for quite some time now. They merged together in for the DREAM trial in 1 year and for the EVAR-1 trial in 2 years, and have essentially stayed together in EVAR-1 till 8 years and DREAM till 6 years. So there isn't any indication that they're separating.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that they couldn't all of a sudden at 8 years or 9 years separate, of course, but there just isn't any indication that if the studies are carried out another 4 or 5 years, that the endovascular patients will fare worse than the open patients. The second point, which I think is really important, most patients with aneurysms are elderly.
Yeah.
And so at about 8 to 10 years, a significant number of these people are not alive for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And so with the question of durability, it's not like you have a young breast cancer patient that's going to live another 25 to 30 years. Most of these patients are not. So the durability has to be, in some patients, 8 years, and some patients maybe 10, and maybe for some longer, 15 or so. But so 8 years for this patient population is a fairly long period of time, and the fact that the outcomes are equivalent at 8 years is fairly persuasive.
Okay. Now, with a longer-term need, with the need for more reinterventions with endovascular repair, a lot of these patients are going to be out of the care of their surgeon by the time reintervention becomes necessary. Are there things that primary care clinicians should be looking for in these patients that might alert them to the fact that they've got to get back to their surgeon?
To the point of reinterventions, there is little doubt that reinterventions are necessary in these patients. And if you look at both the DREAM and the EVAR-1 trial, the rate of reintervention was about 30% at 6 and 8 years for each of these trials. So that's a fairly significant rate of reintervention. The interesting thing is that in the DREAM trial, they looked at the rate of reintervention following open surgery, because things happen after open surgery, hernias, wound infections, pseudoaneurysms, and such. And the reintervention rate was 20% after open surgery, i.e. only 10% different than for endovascular repair. And interestingly enough, in the DREAM trial, where they measured the reintervention rate for the open procedures, they didn't look at bowel obstructions, which is a sort of a major problem that can happen after open surgery. So it's not so clear that the reintervention rate for endovascular aneurysm repair is actually that dramatically different than it is for open surgery. I just think for many years we have kind of ignored the patients after open surgery and not really counted up the number of times they get in trouble over the long term. That said, and in answer to your question, the patients that have received endovascular aneurysm repair do need to be monitored for life. And that's an important finding in these studies. There was some belief that most of the reinterventions would happen early on, and that if patients passed through that phase well, that they wouldn't have to be followed because their grafts would then be durable for life. And that's not the case. Even at 8 years, there's patients that need reintervention. So these patients need to be monitored very well. And whether they're monitored by their surgeon or by their primary care physician is really inconsequential, but they need to be monitored. And although there are a number of different paradigms that have been espoused in terms of how to best monitor these patients, if things seem reasonably stable, their aneurysm should be looked at least once a year. And that once a year examination can either be a CAT scan or in the hands of someone that has a fair amount of expertise, a really good ultrasound. And the types of things that you look for are, one, whether the aneurysm is expanding, and then on both a CAT scan and an ultrasound that's performed well, you can actually see if there's any flow within the aneurysm or whether all of the blood flows within the graft. So those are the essential things to look for. But I'm not sure it matters whether that monitoring is done by a surgeon or a primary care physician, but it does need to be done.
Okay. In your practice, are you having more of these trade-off conversations, or do you think you'll start having more of them now that these studies have been published?
I think that the studies have reassured me that the conversations that I've been having for years are the right conversations. And so I often, with patients, will explain both techniques, the advantages and disadvantages of both techniques. I'll try to understand the patient in terms of their ability to, you know, have follow-up, their ability to want or be accessible for monitoring over the long term, and what their fear is of a major operation, and try to integrate that into a decision that the patient helps me with in terms of whether to choose a open repair or endovascular repair. But just to sum the issues, there are some people that are mostly relatively young who have little desire to get ultrasounds or CAT scans every year, that are not so fearful of a, you know, reasonably significant operation, that will certainly opt for an open repair, and will feel much more comfortable with that approach than putting in a stent. And then there's a whole host of patients, mostly older, who are very fearful of having an open repair, would rather be in the hospital overnight and recover in a couple of weeks, and are very willing to pay the price, which is this long-term monitoring, the need for reintervention, to have the endovascular repair. But I think every patient deserves a conversation about the advantages and disadvantages of both techniques, and their own persona and abilities need to be weighed in to making a final decision about how to treat that patient.
Well, I could recommend your editorial as a good place for anyone wanting to have their first conversation to start. It was very clear, and it helps put the issue into perspective. Well, thank you for your advice, Dr. Kent, and thanks for your time with us today.
Thank you very much for asking.
Well, there we have it again, another edition of Clinical Conversations, and you can reach us at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, and all links for our news stories are available there as well. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano, and I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, and thanks for listening.